This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we hear what it was like to grow up white in Rhodesia in the midst of the civil war over white rule. The whites lost the war and Rhodesia became Zimbabwe. Alexandra Fuller was born in England in 1969. In 1972, she moved with her family to a farm in Rhodesia. Alexandra's father, Tim, fought on the side of the white government in the Civil War. He was often away, leaving his wife, Nicola, and their children to fend for themselves. The Fullers were eventually forced to leave Zimbabwe. They moved on to farm in Malawi and Zambia. Today, Alexandra Fuller lives in Wyoming. Her parents and her sister and her family continue to live in Zambia. Alexandra Fuller has written a memoir about her childhood in Africa, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. She joins us this afternoon to talk about her family and their life in Africa. Listeners, I invite your questions for Alexandra Fuller. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight is published by Random House. Alexandra Fuller joins us this afternoon from Chicago, where tonight, January 30th, she will be doing a signing and a reading at Women and Children First, which is located at 5233 North Clark Street. And that reading and signing is set for 7:30 this evening. Again, the telephone number is 333-9455-800-222-9455. Alexandra Fuller, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. What a great read.
Thank you.
What led your family to Africa? Where were your parents born?
Well, mother is from Kenya. My father's English went out to Kenya to see a giraffe. Usual story. You know, Africa got into his blood and he never left. And they are really such frontiers people. It seems to me, looking back, I mean, of course, when you're in the middle of it, you're just going with the flow. But looking back, it seems to me they were always pushing the brink of civilization. First, that farm that we moved to right up against the Mozambique border in 1974, when the war was just starting to get hot, they called it. And they bought this farm on a whim. I mean, my mum and dad really used to act out of instinct, I think, rather than judgment, and out of a passion for the land. So they loved the view from the veranda of this house that they bought on the Mozambique border. And it was a gorgeous view of these lovely Mozambique mountains. But what it, in reality, it was a view of the minefields that separated Rhodesia and Mozambique. So my sister and I would lie in bed at night and hear the minefields, the mines and the minefields detonating. And, you know, mum and dad were saying, lovely view, isn't it? And the farm itself was unworkable, really, because it was pushed right up against the mountains. Cattle kept sort of falling over and breaking their legs, and it wasn't very good for cropping. So their passion is just this illogical dream in many ways.
Yeah. You write in the book, in Rhodesia, we are born, and then the umbilical cord of each child is sewn straight from the mother onto the ground where it takes root and grows.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I've lived in the United States for 8 years, and that almost physical ache for Africa has finally overwhelmed me. And I'm taking my two children and my husband back to Africa at the end of the year. It is a passion for people who love it. I spoke to a man recently who had been in Africa, who now lives in the States, who said, you know, there's two kinds of people who go to Africa. There's millions of different colors, but there's only two kinds, people who love it and people who hate it. I love it.
Mm. Prior to those sentences about being born and then being tied to the ground,
yeah.
You write, Rhodesia has more history stuffed into its make-believe colonial dream borders than one country the size of a very large teapot should be able to amass in less than 100 years without cracking. Then you continue, but all the history of this land returns to the ground on which we stand because all of us, black, white, colored, Indian, old-timers, newcomers, are fighting for the same thing, tillable, rain-turned-over, fresh, fertile, warm, worm-smelling soil, land on which to grow tobacco, cattle, cotton, soybeans, sheep, women, children. It's an interesting order. You put it there.
You know, I don't think I thought of that until you said it, but that's exactly the order my father would have put it. Back on soybeans first.
No.
Do you know, I think that people have made the comment that my parents weren't very nurturing, that there was this very sort of hands-off approach to our upbringing. And that wasn't true because, well, in a way, you know, I mean, it depends what your version of nurturing is. They certainly didn't coddle us. But what was important was that we had food, was that we were fed. So I think there was this assumption that if food was grown, the children would sort of take care of themselves. And what they ultimately taught me was incredible self-preservation. My mother said to me when I was out of high school, I had graduated, she said, go on, off you go. It was the first time I was going to go overseas. And I was quite nervous to sort of go over to the Western world. And she said to me, Bobo, there's nothing they can do to you now. And I carry those words with me everywhere. There is nothing anybody can do to me that can be any worse than anything we've already had to go through, but in a wonderful, wonderful way. They taught me incredible courage and optimism. And it wasn't always, it wasn't always what I would call moral or even right.
Mm-hmm.
I write in the book about how Mum decided one day to go and herd up these cattle that were only technically ours, very loose technicality at that. We were basically stealing cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So we pile on the horses and off we go all day. And rounding up these cows at the top of the farm, it was hot, hot, hot. And I was very scared. I knew that the place, there was a jolly good chance it would be bristling with liberation fighters and that I would be a lovely target up there on the horse. And Mum wouldn't give up. She was determined to round these cattle up and bring them down to the home paddocks. She said that they were diseasing our cattle and that they were eating all our grazing. Eventually I started whining about how tired and thirsty and hungry I was, and her response was, well, ride your horse then, let's get these cattle in, and then you can get what you want. And, you know, that learning at a very, very young age that your comfort is directly related to the soil and how hard you work, I think is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you?
Oh, and that... In that, I was probably 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're on a pony.
9 or 10. Yes, yeah, I had this little fat, nasty thing that bucked and bolted and reared and bit and kicked. And every time it savaged me, my father would say, well, make you into a better horsewoman. Pain builds character.
And there's the heat, and there are what you now call liberation fighters, but at the time you called them terrorists.
That's right, yes.
And they're about, and then there's the heat. You have no water with you.
Right.
And there's the vegetation is awfully nasty as well.
Yeah, the buffalo bean, yes. And the equivalent, I suppose, of poison ivy, except that it's windborne, these little hairs that dig under your skin, yes.
Sounds worse than poison ivy.
Yeah.
And then there are giant spiders lurking about.
Right. No, I have no fear of spiders. And you know, the thing is, too, is that you have to remember, it's not as if I came from a city or you know, what we perceive of as a comfortable Western life. This was all I knew. This was not extraordinary for me. And I didn't just know it. I loved it, even then, even living it. I thought my mother was the most beautiful, glamorous, passionate woman I'd ever met in my life. In fact, I used to wonder how on earth I was ever going to live up to her. She had a brilliant, brilliant madness. And I think it was only after my sister Olivia died, which I write about in the book, that I feel as if that madness turned from being brilliant to sometimes terrifying.
And Olivia wasn't the only child your mother lost.
Right. No.
Yeah, Two others. That really had to take a toll, not only on your mother, but your father as well.
You know, I went back a couple of months ago to Mum and Dad. They now live on the Zambezi River in Zambia. And I talked to them about this. I said, listen, I'm going to have to talk about Olivia and Richard and Adrian, and I'm going to have to talk about you, and I'm going to have to talk about the war in our lives, and we have never talked about it. And I feel as if we really should. If I'm going to talk to perfect strangers about this, maybe it's about time we sat down. So, a bit reluctantly. You know, we're British. We aren't officially supposed to have feelings. I plunked them down and I said, listen, I, especially about Olivia, I just feel this tremendous guilt. And my dad said to me, he always talks as if you're on horseback at the time. And he said, Bobo, don't look back. You'll get wiped off on the next branch ahead of you. He said, just, you've got to keep looking forward. You can't feel guilty about that. And we can't keep living in the past. And I think that's why they were able to get through this. I think that's what they did. I mean, after my sister Olivia drowned, which was the most sort of, I think, life-stopping. Really, God, I mean, if anything could just freeze the blood in your body, it was... when the day she died, I mean, the grief was just crippling for all of us. And Mum and Dad piled us in the Peugeot and said, right, we're going to go on vacation, such as it was. So we took tinned food and sleeping bags and drove across Rhodesia in the middle of a war. We were the only idiots on the road. Nobody else would have braved it. But that literally moving away from grief. My parents did very well.
Your parents almost seem like they, from time to time, either they are almost unaware of the danger that is around them.
Yeah.
Or they couldn't care less. They're just going to get on with their lives.
Yes. Yes, I think that's how it was. Or they dived into it very often. Almost created it.
Tell the story about your mother getting on a horse,
right,
and riding into a campsite where some homesteaders, some squatters have come after the war, and this is shortly before you're moved off that place in Burma Valley.
Well,
she almost got you killed, if you ask me.
Killed. Mum, the dreadful thing about that was that Mum was pregnant with her fifth child, and I think we all knew that this was our last chance for another baby, and we were all desperate for this baby. And because it was her fifth child, and she was fairly old at the time, she was in her late 30s by then, she was very heavy, even though she wasn't terribly, terribly pregnant. And I remember her in her fury, this white fury, bashing her belly against the saddle as she swung up on this horse. Huge, this ex-trotter that she had, this thoroughbred. And, come on, Bobo. I mean, barely gave me time to sort of scramble up on my wretched little red horse. And off we sort of galloped across the farm. And it was at the top end of the farm where, after the war, squatters that had been made refugees from the war and had been sort of patching a life together in Mozambique had come flooding back over the border now that Rhodesia was free. And they obviously landed on our farm first. We were the first farm on beyond Mozambique. And they had chopped down a patch of virgin forest and set up a farm against a river so that they would have easy access to water. And it infuriated my mother because it meant that the water was being contaminated for our use and that it was also being used up before we could get it on our crops. and it infuriated her that they were chopping down virgin forest against a hill and that the hill would be washed away. And it infuriated her because she felt this was her land and she'd put her blood and sweat and soul into it. And she really had run that farm for the duration of the war because my father was away fighting. And she had run that farm through a pregnancy, through the death of her child, and in extremely dangerous conditions. And I think she just, she was mad with rage that she felt her farm was being, her property was being violated. So she charged on her horse into this sort of makeshift squatter camp and ran her horse at people, at these villagers. And I remember the children screaming and cowering behind their mothers and the men shouting and the dog, their dogs coming up and barking at our dogs. And I remember sort of cringing under the thatch of a hut. And for the first time, it was as if the whole war was in front of me, the whole reason for the war. Everything suddenly made sense. I mean, there was my mother, a white woman, who had, you know, bought this land and had used it. Here were these settlers who felt the land was theirs too. Here was my mother trying to kill them. Here were these people trying to defend themselves. And then one of the village women picked up a calabash and hit my mother's horse on the nose with it. And that was at the last thread that my mother might have had to sanity snapped. And she just charged her horse at this woman who had a small baby. And I just remember staring at her, almost screaming at my mother, I think, in terror. On the one hand, terrified she would be hurt. On the other hand, terrified that she would hurt somebody, and feeling this terrible, helpless sense of compassion for absolutely everybody. By the time we got back to the farm, not much later after that, we had been reported to the Zimbabwe army for assault and were held up at gunpoint for a good part of the afternoon. Because obviously, you know, for obvious reasons. Yeah.
It strikes me in this scene, in this part of the story, where your family's life is coming apart and the lives of those squatters are coming once again apart, that metaphor that you use of the cracked teapot is so perfect.
And do you know, I had no way of knowing this when I wrote the book, but it couldn't be more apt than now. Because I really do think that the sins of our fathers, I mean, come back and sort of visit. It's true that the sort of horrors of the past can really create a template for a violent future, which is what Zimbabwe has going on now. President Robert Mugabe, who's the current president of Zimbabwe, is using the draconian laws imposed by the white Rhodesian regime under Ian Smith to deny his people the vote. And he is denying the war veterans who fought for a voice, and now he's denying them their voice. And it occurs to me that this is, unfortunately, too often the pattern in Africa, certainly, these dictators.
Do you think Zimbabwe will make its way through?
I wish I had a crystal ball. I think that there are Zimbabweans who are determined to stay and to fight for democracy. And I think as long as there are people who are prepared to speak out against Mugabe's oppressive regime, and as long as there are people, brave, brave men, I mean, Morgan Tsvangirai, who's the opposition leader, who are prepared to risk their lives, really, for freedom, then yes, there's hope. I feel desperately, desperately sad for the country. The image of that cracked teapot, too, I often think, in a way, too, of my mother's madness as that sort of cracked feeling of, the insanity of living in a country and fighting to keep yourselves in power when you're the minority, and that sort of thin, thin glass of sort of colonial power. was bound to crack and break at some point. And that's where I think this book is different from, you know, it's been likened, obviously. The names that have been pulled up have been Karen Blixen, or I guess Isaac Dinesen is how we would know her, and Beryl Markham. And, you know, people have asked me how this book is different, and I point out that they were writing in that sort of the glory days of the sort of, I call it the Kenyan picnic, you know, and it was all fun and games out on the lawn, terribly romantic and a touch of malaria here and there. But my book is set when the tea party is breaking up and the teapot starts to crack.
Not a romantic view of Africa.
Not at all, no.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us this afternoon in Champaign County on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. There was a South African jurist. I think he's on the Supreme Court. I've been trying to remember his name at great length, but I can't, and I haven't been able to actually find a book that would have his name in it. I guess I should have gone to Google search or something, but he's the fellow that was chronicled quite widely in the West. He had a bomb, letter bomb sent to him. What I'm getting at was he was on these airwaves, and he was interviewed, and I think I called him and asked him. He was talking about the same kind of land reform.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the same kind. Are you remembering who I'm thinking of? He's a Jewish fellow. Was in the ANC.
When was this?
Well, he was in the ANC all through the liberation struggle.
So are you talking about 92 or more recently than that, that he was...
Well, he's on the Supreme Court now. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter who he is.
Yeah.
Somebody can look him up. But he asserted that the you know, the land reform problems, the problem of this colonial dispossession.
Yeah.
And he was very critical of British... I mean, it's something that we don't hear much in the press. The Lancaster Accords were how the war was settled and
That's
independence
right.
was given. And it included the commitment by the British to help finance land reform.
Well, yes.
Mugabe is criticized widely by Zimbabweans for a lot of reasons. So one is not starting the land reform sooner.
Yes.
But the British, in particular under Thatcher, I think, were recalcitrant all along. So what I'm just saying is that I think what we're saying is the problem, you know, Mugabe, you know, the war veterans should have been put up with, you know, land much very long ago. I mean, some kind of thing, and it's not just Mugabe's recalcitrance, it's also the recalcitrance of the West. And even to this day, I think the British government could be more forthcoming about commitments to finance land reform. It's not something, a point of view you hear very much. It was affirmed by this fellow, and his name is still not coming to me.
Yeah.
But I would like your comments on that. I had something to ask you about Cecil Rhodes and the whole history of Rhodesia as well, if we have time for that. But could you talk about your reflections on that whole sort of analysis?
Actually, it's a fairly commonly held view, both within Zimbabwe and without. And I don't think there's any doubt that land reform, you know, should have taken place earlier under rule of law, with proper compensation to the farmers, the commercial farmers. And when Mugabe first came to power, there was widespread land. There was one sort of surge of land acquisitions, which were quite peaceable, among which was my parents' farm in the Burma Valley, is now under Zimbabwean ownership. What the Zimbabwean commercial farmers have seen and what they are fighting against is that non-farmers were given land. And, you know, it would be rather like giving me control of a computer center. I have no idea. Or even really giving me a farm. I mean, I'm not a farmer. And so very often, sadly, this land is either neglected, overused to the point that it turns into a desert, or left to run down into complete neglect. The land seizures, such as they are, occurring now are violent. I think there's a perception that white farmers are being are the only people being hurt and harassed during these land seizures. In fact, very few have been killed. Very few white farmers have been killed. Quite a few have been shot. A lot have been harassed and beaten up. But they are not getting the brunt of the abuse. It's the African farm laborers who are desperate to hold on to their jobs, desperate to keep their children in school, desperate to stay on the farms where there is a degree of health care and where there is housing and, it's a far knottier problem, I think, and getting knottier almost by the hour, whereas, as you say, quite rightly, if it had been taken care of with more assistance from the West earlier on, I don't think we'd be in quite the mess we are now. However, I think there's agreement within Zimbabwe, and certainly the opposition feel that the way the land is being seized now is not workable. The Zimbabweans don't want it. It's ruining the economy. It's stopped tourism. And there's widespread famine as a result of the farm seizures. This year, Zimbabwe will produce roughly a quarter the food that it produced a year ago, because so many of the farms have been put out of operation. And Zimbabwe used to be self-sufficient.
It's such a rich land, and
yes,
clearly the mineral wealth has been quote-unquote developed for quite a while. And
right.
I don't know whether there's been any reform in that and ownership. I think there's been a little bit, but only probably around the edges, because you don't mess with that.
It's not just the farms that have been taken over. I don't know how closely you've been following the Zimbabwean sort of what's going on there now. But businesses, safaris, you know, everything from foreign-owned, actually, some foreign-owned companies have been taken over. War veterans are just marching in there with guns and saying, this is ours now.
Mm.
All of
that should have been done quite a while ago, I think. And I think there should have been some kind of equitable nationalization or some kind of repatriation of all that wealth to the people who have been abused for so long personally. And I don't know. The whole idea that Rhodes started this out as sort of his own personal enterprise is such a bizarre story.
Mm-hmm.
And the dynamic between his sort of leaving the British, the decadent West behind to forage out, and I don't know what to do. I mean, to create his own empire, basically.
Yeah.
But I'm tending to blather. I wish I could remember the name of the fellow that was who was saying that he's kind of in the position where he's ruling on some reform of land in South Africa, and the dynamic is the same. You have a post-colonial situation, and a lot of it...
Are you from farming stock, or...?
Well, I guess, yeah, I'm from southern Illinois, yeah.
Would you... you see, this is not necessarily my view, but some Zimbabweans would say, do you think that, you know, that I land... Never in the New World, it's never been pretty, the way that land was seized. I think that in our case, in the case of Zimbabweans, it's raw. It's more raw. It's a fresher experience. The reason why, another reason why I really felt I had to write this book, is I really didn't want to romanticize the white colonial settlers. I wanted to put out there the truth of the racism and of the way that it felt unfair even to me as a child. In fact, it felt mad. It felt really crazy to be fighting to keep a country white run. And it felt to me unsustainable even then as a child. And I almost don't think that we can look back and judge. I don't think that's, as my father would say, you're going to get wiped out on the tree in front of you. I think we need to occupy the space that we're in now with good judgment, with compassion, and wisely.
Well, but it has to be informed by history, it seems to me. And I think Americans are particularly sensitive to this whole subject, in a sense, because we are a sort of, we are also definitely a colonial settler
right.
state. And if we open up the idea of, some kind of fairness for the original inhabitants, we did a better job of wiping them all out, I regret. But it is more distant in history, too, as you say.
Yes.
Well, I'll hang up and listen to
that. Thank you for your call.
Very good.
Bye. Other calls are encouraged. Welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you happen to be listening, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Alexandra Fuller, she's the author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. She grew up in Rhodesia, what is now Zimbabwe. Also, she spent some time living with her family in Malawi and Zambia. Today she makes her home in Wyoming, although she and her family are going to return to Africa. You met your husband in Africa, Alexandra.
Yeah.
And I'm suspecting that he loves Africa as well.
Yes.
But I wonder if he has some reservations about living there.
No.
No, okay.
No. You know, really, I think for him, too, the sense of, you know, he has that passion for the place. And that what we as a family or as a couple, I suppose, really need to, well, what we feel we'd like to move back to is really in Africa there's the constant reminder of the difference between what is a luxury and what's a necessity. And I think that I would love my children to grow up with a clearer knowledge of that.
Hmm. Yeah. How old are your children now?
I have a daughter who's 8 and a son who's 4.
Hmm. And the 8-year-old, what is she, she's old enough for you to have talked with her about this?
Oh, and she was born in Zimbabwe. She
okay.
was born in Marandera, and she spent her babyhood on the banks of the Zambezi. And we've returned to Africa, and I took Sarah back to where she was born in Zimbabwe. And I've taken them back to the farms that I grew up on.
Mm.
And actually, I took them back to the Burma Valley.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana. Line 1, good afternoon.
Hello. 10 points for Paul on the last call. You know, we really have to come to grips with being a settler colonial people. It's very difficult. And we're certainly getting nothing from our own government that wants to do remarkable things in Afghanistan is going to do absolutely nothing for Africa. And there's a real racist component in this. I wonder if you could comment on that. I'll let you go. Ciao.
Thank you. It's a difficult question for me. Obviously, I speak of my passion for Africa, so you would know how I feel about it. I think that we cannot turn our back on Africa. Derek Walcott, who's an African-American poet, writes in a wonderful poem something to the effect of, how can I turn my back on Africa and live? And I think that turning our back on Africa is a tremendous mistake. It's the birthplace of all mankind. It's the cradle of so much innovation, so much beauty, so much of our natural resources are left there, so much of our wild lands. It's a resource of people, minerals, ideas. To be purely, I suppose, crass and marketing about it, it's a potential market for America. I'm not sure that throwing aid at Africa has been a successful strategy, but I think holding out a hand in partnership, and real partnership, not sort of a patronizing handshake, is where we need to go.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the book where you are playing, you're only 4 years old, I believe, and you're playing Your sister's gone off to boarding school, and you're playing with the African children on the property, but you're playing a very peculiar game.
Oh, yeah.
Boss and boys.
Yeah.
And you, of course, are the boss. Mm. And you talked a moment ago about realizing when you were a child how the insanity of what was happening in Rhodesia.
Yeah.
But yet, there's all this baggage, isn't there? There's all this, I mean, and I don't know. You want to talk about that? It's not a very well-formed question, but...
I think I can see what you're getting at. I think what I did with this, quote-unquote baggage, was write the truth out of it. And the reason I think why I could do that, and I didn't feel like I had to lie about the racism and lie, you know, about the past, was that it's in a cliche, but the truth really sets you free. Obviously, I playing with African children on the farm as boss and boys, when that situation was reversed after independence in 1980, in my boarding school there were 4 white children and about 200 black African children. And these black African children, I write about them in the book, very often were recruited by the freedom fighters to fight for freedom, either as runners or informers. And so they were an active service. And here they were coming into schools that had until then been denied them. They had been denied the kind of fabulous education I had received. And, there I was, sort of hands on hips, the boss, little Muzungu madam. And they didn't despise me. They didn't spit on me or, spurn me. They didn't really even say anything, but the spirit of forgiveness and the spirit of welcoming and the spirit of inclusion was so expansive that it would have been almost impossible for me to have felt any kind of bitterness or any kind of resentment about my past. And I don't think that sort of continually cringing in guilt about a past that was really over by the time I was 11 would be in any way constructive for me. Mm. It would have just paralyzed me, I think. And if we'd all done that, I think it would paralyze our ability to move on as a people. In 1980, when Zimbabwe became independent, Mugabe spoke so eloquently of reconciliation. Would that it had gone that way.
Another listener is waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that when you're talking about, kind of your optimism about the future, about American aid, that I think it's probably good to realize that America's aid always comes with strings, and it's usually never... there's always an agenda. And that American aid usually has to do with our own interests and our own corporate interests and our interest in exploiting mineral wealth or like you mentioned the marketing, but actually that's probably the very worst motive that you ever want to suggest, because there's so much damage being done all over the world with America moving in and looking for markets and exploiting the research, the resources of other countries, for our own benefit. And I doubt there's any place in the world where we've gone in, with aid and, with businesses and corporations that's really, truly benefited the people there. It's really all in our own self-interest. So, I hope the aid really comes from perhaps other countries.
That's a fabulous point. I think the other thing that we tend to, I'm going to speak for myself. How about that? as a white African and certainly being friends with many Africans, what I find astonishing is Africans are among the most pragmatic, most resilient survivors that I know. And I, I don't think that it's beyond, certainly not beyond me as an African, to stand up on my own two feet and to fend for myself. I write in the book about an instance where my dad and I, well, my dad took my sister and I out camping on this vast farm. It was 250,000 acres. It was a ranch, really. And we would have to drive all day in Land Rover to get to the camps that we were staying at. My father was rounding up these wild cattle. And driving back one day to the headquarters, we got 8 flat tires. Every tire that we had was flat. So we couldn't move. We couldn't get back to headquarters. We were running out of water. We were out of any kind of food. And so Dad sent one of the cattlemen, who was actually a tracker, his name was Kephas, was an extremely talented tracker, back to the headquarters to fetch help so that my sister and my father and I and the men that were with us who had been helping my father round up the cattle, could get safely back to headquarters. And this man ran. My father gave him a packet of cigarettes and said, all right, off you go. He ran for 2 days without food and with very little water to get help. And it wasn't what struck me as an adult. At the time, I didn't think it was that remarkable, but that was the whole point of it. It didn't seem that remarkable. I mean, Africans daily endure the most incredible circumstances. With such fortitude that I know it's within African people themselves to help themselves, too. Mm. Certainly within this little African person self, says me, trying to speak for myself.
We're out of time. I'm sorry to say. It's just been a pleasure speaking with you, Alexandra.
Oh, and thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
And the best of luck to you and your family. And your trip back to Africa.
Thank you very much.
Alexandra Fuller has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. She's the author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight is published by Random House.